If you listen to this podcast frequently, it would be very generous and nice of you to become a patron. Go to www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com, look for that little button that says Patreon, and press it, and you can give $2, $5, or $10, and you'll get some gifts and a bunch of shit, or maybe not, or maybe you don't want anything. Maybe you just want to give me money. That's fine. You can also do that through PayPal. Just put in jugheadsbasement@gmail.com. But if you don't have the money, which is okay, I still want you to listen to this podcast. But please share it with your friends or enemies or strangers on the street and get weird looks. Or even more so important even then so, go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast and give us a review. An honest but good review. And now, here is episode 55.
In greenest bay and blackest gunk, no emo shall escape our punk. Let those who worship evil bunk beware our power. Wait, I don't want to say that. I'm keep this rolling, I tell you. In greenest bay and blackest gunk, no emo shall escape our punk. Let those who worship evil junk beware. No, that's not right either. In greenest... Hang on. Breath. In greenest bay and blackest gunk, no emo shall escape our punk. Let those who worship evil bunk beware, for here's more Boris junk.
What was that?
That was the monologue.
Well, that sucked.
I tell ya, tonight, tonight.
Come on, everybody, cause I got a couple things to tell ya. Everybody, cause we got a couple shirts to sell ya. We got 96 tears, times 138. You wanna do nothing, wanna wait, wait, wait.
Hello, this is John Jughead, and you are now listening to I Tell Ya, Tonight, Tonight by Boris the Sprinkler on their 2019 record, Vespa to Venus, on Beer City Records. So, welcome to episode 55 of Jughead's Basement, subcategory, lo-fi interviews with hi-fi guests. This episode featuring Reverend Norb of Boris the Sprinkler. In our conversation, we talk about Spider-Man, collecting and disposing of stuff, show costumes, science, guilty pleasures, and much, much, much more, less so more. So, with no further ado, let us begin.
I tell ya, tonight's the night I make my move again.
Wow, I'm looking good.
Yeah, you look great. We both look great.
Oh, okay. There, you can see me now. All right. Hooray.
I can see you. Norb just entered the waiting room, was the words on my screen, and I let you in.
Wow, that's one of Fugazi's two good songs.
Are there more than two?
There's like two and a half. I think that I kind of like song number one. There's Waiting Room and there's Bad Mouth.
You know, I really wanted to like that record too. And Waiting Room, honestly, I mean, was the only song I liked on it. I really tried to like them. I almost feel disappointed in myself.
Yeah, I gave them an honest shot. I had plenty of Fugazi records that I got in some way, shape, or form. And I sold them all except the first one because that one's got the two good songs on it. You're selling them short, two good songs.
Yeah, I eventually saw The Even, and I actually like them more. They're just really stripped down. It was acoustic.
Huh. I'm not aware. I do know Ian McKay likes even numbers because I asked him once what his favorite number was, and I don't remember what his answer was. He said, like, I had him pegged for an odd number guy. I read him wrong. I did him wrong. I did him the dirty, man.
Is that a question you find yourself asking people?
I'm not sure. It was just apparently I needed to know that very badly.
Do you always find yourself needing to know something very badly?
Inquiring minds want to know. Well, how about you? Do you like odd or even numbers?
You're asking me?
Yes, I am.
I like prime numbers.
Is that a fact?
Well, it's a subset of odd in general, right? Are they
in general, except for two.
Except for right. Two. Yeah, but I think two is okay because you need two. You know, to have a society, you need at least two people.
That's true. I heard about that in a song by Three Dog Night once. Or who did one of the loneliest number? Was that Three Dog Night or was that?
Well, they did the cover of it. They did the cover of what's his name? Who did the Schmerler record? Schmeisler. What the heck was his name? He hung out with the Beatles and was a troublemaker. Can't remember his name right now. Harry Nilsson.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, Harry Nilsson. So I'm recording now.
All right. Were we recording before? Was that just the preamble?
No, we were recording before too. I just wanted you. I needed to officially tell you that we were recording.
All right. Thanks.
I see behind you. You have a poster for the amazing the fantasy, which is the first Amazing Spider-Man. His origin story, right? Or is
you are correct.
Has his origin story, or is it just his first appearance?
It is his first appearance and his origin story.
Yeah. See, I never could get that. I collected Amazing Spider-Man comics, but I never got that one. So
I have a copy. It doesn't have a back cover. That's how I could afford it. But everything.
Oh. Yeah. See, I was never a big collector, but back in like the 80s, who was that? It was my sister's boyfriend, and I was a lonely kid, so I wanted some, and this guy sort of took interest in me, and he had a bag of comic books that he gave me, and then I started collecting, and I mostly collected for the cover art, and I really took to like the cover of Amazing Spider-Man. So I have a lot of the early, you know, the 12-cent versions of the a lot of the early Spider-Mans.
Yeah, I've got the first 100 issues.
Do you? Consecutively, 1, 2, 3, all the way to 100.
100. Actually, I have 1 through 102 because 100 starts a three-part story with Morbius, the living vampire. So I've got, I saw that one out to the end. So I've got from number 1 to 102. And I might have a few after 102, but I can't swear to that in a court of law.
Hmm. Well, you will probably never have to be asked to do that. So you'll probably
never
be
know.
Okay.
We live in a very litigious society.
We do. What came first, comic collecting or being a punk?
Comic book collecting for me. I was, as you said, I'm going to give you my life story here. I was born when I just turned four, we moved from our old neighborhood to a new neighborhood, and it was like not as cool because it was further away from downtown and crap like that. And I was bored because I moved away from my friends and I was lonely, and I discovered comic books then. And then I was like, holy crap, there's all this shit I can learn and read about. And then I was, you know, I was totally gung-ho on comics, but at the time I was about 5, and I think until I was about 13 and discovered punk rock, that's all I wanted to do with my life, was to draw comic books or somehow be involved in the comic book thing. And
yeah,
and I discovered punk rock, and then I was like, oh, all I want to do is just be in a band and be a no good punk rock bum and play music and get picture taken, and that's all they did.
Norb, sell me on the one thing is I could never really get into the writing of comics. I love the art, but for some reason it never hooked me. What is comic book writing, and why is it so popular?
I don't think I can actually answer that, because I don't know if the writing is just sort of there so the characters have something to do. You know, it gives you the plots, and it gives you the cover where you got the villain, and it gives you sort of the history where, well, yes, Dr. Octopus first appeared in Spider-Man number 3, and then he tried to do something or other in Spider-Man number 10. And then you have this whole sort of history and this mythology in the backlog. So I don't think it's so much the writing. I think it's just sort of like creating the basis, the foundations for the mythology. And I think if you notice that there's these superhero movies that have apparently become popular, or so the kids tell me, like they're just sort of taking that mythology that was built in the 60s and sort of transporting it. So apparently, I think the writer is just really laying the groundwork for the mythology, and then the story and all that stuff is kind of is some necessary evil.
Yeah, which I think I don't think I'm making this up, but I think Stan Lee did talk about his sort of fascination with like mythology in general. Like,
yeah, I believe,
like when he was coming in, and when he was coming to popularity, it was the same time like Joseph Campbell was writing about myth and heroes and all that. I think they were, a lot of those comics were influenced by that sort of writing. I think they were all really into that, the old timey, really old timey mythology, like Greek mythology. And
yeah, well, I know, like, you know, if you, I can actually grab my freaking reference right off the shelf. Oh, I'm knocking shit over. I was going to grab my copy of Origins of Marvel Comics by Stan Lee, which is actually within hand shot, but now I'm knocking my Star Trek DVDs over. He does say when he was talking about inventing Thor that he was always into Norse mythology, because, yeah, I think that Joseph Campbell, he's most known for the monomyth. I think that was like the late 40s, maybe, when that book came out.
Joseph Campbell?
That was Joseph Campbell, right? I think. He was German.
Yeah, yeah. And he did. Well, you know, actually, our song, Science of Myth, was based because Ben was reading Joseph Campbell's. He came in, had another big resurgence like in the late 80s, early 90s. As you see, Norb, I don't really have a plan for this interview. You know, I was talking to Patty from Dillinger 4 last week, and I said one of the reasons I started doing these podcasts is because I've been in the punk scene since, I don't know, since I was 17, like 85. And I immediately went into the, sort of the business aspect of it with Ben. You know, it was, we were kind of like a machine. And it wasn't really wasn't my job in my mind to get to know everybody. I just kind of was too busy making it work. So I felt like years ago, a couple of years ago, I realized I didn't know all these people that I had spent my whole life with. Like I didn't know who they were. And it's not natural to me because I'm usually very, I mean, intimate person in general. So it just.
So you felt an existential void, and now you're like going to correct the great imbalance in the system. I'm going to blow my nose since you talk so nobody uses it.
No, yeah. You say that, then I stop talking. So now I'm talking just to talk. But that is one of the reasons I was doing it. And I guess it leads to one of my first questions, because I was listening to an interview you did for this, what was it called? It was talking about origins. It was like Origins of Bands. I can't remember. It was like a local podcast that I think you did last year. Or no, 1999 or something like that, years ago. But you had said it as advice at the end, don't get attached to the first things you do. You're giving some like advice to like musicians, and I live by that sort of too, but I'm in a theater group where we create stuff every week. So you can't be precious. It sounded like a very idea of being, not being precious. But I wanted to ask you of how is your relation, as I think you're a writer and a musician and a just person in the world. How does that relate to you dealing with the past? Like you don't get stuck in nostalgia, but that, you know, I guess I'm asking, how do you look in the past and deal with it and move into the present without falling into nostalgia? Or is that a thing you ever worried about?
I consider myself somewhat trapped by nostalgia because, you know, I'm still seem to be sort of stuck with the trappings of my childhood and things like that, because I've got stacks of comic books everywhere, in case you haven't quite picked up on that. Yeah. It seems to be sort of hearkening back to childhood. I've got records all over, which is a hearkening back to the teenage years. Everything I do seems to be in some way, shape, or form trying to just hold on to these tenuous moments that are already gone, which means that, like, when it's my time and I'm about to reach my reward, the end of the line, and, you know, I'm going to pass away, I'm going to have a really hard time with it because I don't seem to be able to let anything go. So I think, to me, nostalgia is just sort of hoarding and accumulating all these experiences as well as the physical trappings of them. So I think you just keep adding to the pile.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Well, I guess but the important element that I would say for you, Norb, is that you're able to stay in the present moment to keep gaining those sort of, that look into the past without it being stopping you from moving forward. I'm getting very philosophical right away, because I guess I'm sort of dealing with this stuff too, where you want to analyze your past because it's so incredible, the things we've done, like as musicians or in punk bands and the people we've met and the things we've done, but you don't want to get stuck in that. So I guess I'm just really into this idea of balancing the present with the past and how you could still use the past to affect your, you know, your right now.
Yeah. I think the thing is about holding on to the past is eventually you're going to realize that you've already sort of peaked at whatever it was you were doing. Like, you're not going to be able to, you know, I don't know, be in the same band or write the same kind of songs or write the same kind of writing or make music or whatever. At some point in time, you know, you're going to hit your peak, and then you're going to start sliding, and then you're going to start trying to hold on to where you were instead of going forward. And we all do that to a certain point in time. At some point in time, you have to know when to just like say, okay, this part is done. It's time to do something else. And let's just see where that goes. Cause otherwise you're going to be spending the rest of your life trying to claw back 1995 or something. And it's not going to work well for you.
Yeah. Do you find yourself still trying to catch on to some pop culture elements like around you, or have you, is it harder to capture that stuff in your life right now?
Like, such as?
See, I don't know. I'm very bad at it. I don't even know what music is out there right now. I don't have a TV, so I don't, you know, I have Netflix and stuff, so I know what's out there, but I don't hold on to things as much as I used to in that way.
Yeah, you know, I try to go. I go down to the record store every Friday, and sometimes I buy something, and sometimes I don't. And sometimes I'm happy with what I buy, and sometimes I'm not. And I order a lot of old records, you know, records from the '60s,
yeah,
early '70s, maybe, and things like that, or even the '50s. But you know, as far as being that guy that's got his fingers on the pulse beat of what the hell exactly is going on, I think I'm pretty far from being that guy at this point in time.
Yeah,
I mean, you try not to be totally isolated and not have any idea what's going on, but I don't know. It can't possibly have the same impact in your life when you're in your 50s as it does when you're in a teenager, and it's really important that you are like on top of all whatever kind of shit you think is important.
Yeah. Now you actually were one of the many, like you worked at MRR and a couple, and you did a lot of journalist writing. So it was one of your jobs to sort of capture what was going on in the moment. I don't want to talk a lot about it, but I'm just interested in what brought you to being more of a journalist writer. When did you start? You did some teen magazine before MRR?
When I first discovered sort of the more hardcore-y, as you would, the more DIY aspects of punk rock, I was, I think, not quite 16. And that's when like Black Flag and the Circle Jerks and the Dead Kennedys and stuff like that were coming up. So it's, you know, from them, you start branching out to the various bands weren't quite as big as them. And you start discovering that there are publications in other places like Slash or Flipside. And there was this fanzine that was coming out of the Bay Area, out of San Jose, called Ripper, which is kind of a dumb name. It was before Maximum Rock and Roll. It was the big North California punk scene before Maximum Rock and Roll. And I ordered a few issues and I thought it was really great. And they were, you know, there's a little thing at the bottom that says always looking for contributions. So I wrote a record review. I wrote a review of the new TSOL album, which was Dance With Me, which I hated because it was gothy. And I just wrote it up and I sent it in. And I wasn't thinking anybody was going to read it or print it, but the next issue I bought, there it was. There was my review. Like, holy crap, I'm somebody. I had this really bad review of the TSOL first album, and I don't know. And after that, I just started writing all kinds of crap. Then I put out my own fanzine starting when I was 16. That was 1982. And then I just sort of almost habitually, almost chronically have just written somewhere or another about almost everything I do all the time. So I can't really run for public office because every fucked up thought that I've had in my mind since I was 16 years old
is out there somewhere.
Literally everything that I thought is out there, for better or for worse. There's a lot of turf in that particular punch bowl, let me tell you.
Yeah. See, this is one thing that, again, I wasn't, you know, I was aware of everybody in that scene, but I just didn't care to read that stuff. I don't know. I was a bizarre punk, I think. I just kind of lived the life without really being into the reading of it. But I was aware of to me, like in our people, the important sort of writers in that sort of scene were you, Tesco V, Ben himself, like Tim Yohannan, you know, Larry Livermore. So I was aware of everybody and I knew all of them, but I just didn't like to read it. Do you think that's strange?
I don't know, because, you know, it's different because a lot of people like to read a lot of books on like rock and musicians and things like that. And I think that's really a low hanging fruit. When I read books, I mean, once in a while, it'll be about music or something, but usually it isn't, just because the idea of sitting down and reading a book about music doesn't really translate well to something I want to do, even though when I read those books, I usually enjoy them. So I just sort of think it's, some stuff just doesn't have that shelf appeal to each individual person that makes you want to just go, I think I'd like to read that today. Hooray.
Were you taking in that material as you were putting it out? Like, were you an avid reader of all of that while you were putting out material?
It would sort of come and go. I would read some stuff if I thought it would interest me. And then a lot of times I would just gloss over and not read it. So it seemed like more important in the 80s to read all that stuff because we were still trying to figure out what the hell we were doing and trying to get everything together and organized and make a form of community. And probably by the time I started writing for MRR in the 90s, it was like, I don't want to listen anymore. Frickin' punk rockers yap about crap. I mean, some of them you would because they would have interesting viewpoints or whatever, or you just started reading it and you got caught up in it. But as far as I must consume all this, you know, written word about the subject matter of which is so true to my heart, I don't think I felt that way, at least not in the 90s.
Mm. In this interview I just listened to, too, I heard you talking about Originations again of Boris the Sprinkler, and Paul Schroeder had this thing going and then brought you in, tricked you into being in the band.
Yeah, they talked me into it. They did. They wanted me to be in the band, and I didn't want to be in the band because I was being antisocial. Like I back to my life story. I drank a lot. I used to drink a lot, and then I stopped drinking. And then I was just sitting in the house, didn't know what to do because I, you know, wasn't drinking. So I became kind of.
I'm sorry, I interrupted, and then you go back. Did that make that incapable of going out? Were you just afraid of starting to drink again? It just made it hard to
it
be.
It wasn't incapable. It was just too weird. You know, it's like I would go out and I'd drink, you know, Diet Pepsi or whatever. I'm just like, I don't know. This is just dumb. I can't deal with people anymore. Everybody wants to talk, and I don't feel like hanging out and talking anymore. I just wanted to sit in the house by myself and read. And Paul and Eric, number one, and Ron were, you know, they're starting a band. Like, come on over. You can sing. Like, I don't want to sing. I don't do this. You guys are a bunch of jokers. I don't want to deal with it. Then Paul and Ron called me one afternoon. They're like, well, why don't you just come over and play bass? Eric is like, we'll just jam in the basement. I'm like, yeah, all right, I'll do that. So we were just, you know, spending a Sunday afternoon or whatever, just jamming, playing dumb old punk songs. And then Eric showed up. He's the bass player. And he wants his bass, and I'm having fun, so now I got to sing. And there it was. They got me into the fold.
Yeah. Well, you and Paul go pretty way back.
Yeah, I met him at the second show I ever played. I was 15. And he was in the crowd, and I remember thinking, this guy's pretty big. I hope he does not take a disliking to my band and kill me, because that was a long time ago. That's when we were 15. We didn't really know each other that well. We lived in different sides of town, but I met him. I knew who he was.
Yeah. Is he the type of person, do you think, that was an intentional to get you over there and put you on bass and knowing the bass was coming later? Or is that just like a weird circumstantial?
I don't know. The mystery remains a mystery to me.
I guess what I was getting at there was more about, because you talk a little bit about that in this interview, but I was more curious as the thing you said about how some of the music around then has gotten very serious, like hardcore had gotten pretty serious by then. And what you said was that you had this instinct to sort of do something more comical or just not as heavy as things seem to be going in the punk scene. And I feel like Weasel were, I mean, me and Ben have kind of felt the same way. We were in this scene where everyone, I called it the singing to the bar chords. Like it wouldn't be even melodic. It would just be, they'd be singing to the notes they were playing. And it was all about the politicalness of the words they were saying. And I don't know, when I read that or heard that interview, it clicked to me that there were bands probably all over the place that had that zeitgeist moment where you were just like, ah, we need to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like from some point in the 80s, it probably depends on where you were in the scene and where your mind was at, how long you've been. But I mean, everything just became this sort of drudgery, like, and then everybody was playing the same kind of drudgery, and then people completely lost their minds from the drudgery type of hardcore, and they started playing really crappy music with like acoustic guitars that plug in and stuff like that, which was different but not any better. And I think we were like, you know, we used to listen to this music when we were 15 that was punk rock or whatever the hell you want to call it, but it was still kind of fun. Why don't we do something that's kind of fun just to amuse ourselves? I don't care if anybody likes it or not. You know, let's play something with some, I don't know, some freaking spirit to it, as opposed to whatever you want to call that hardcore thing that wasn't any fun, whatever that was.
It seems to be probably no coincidence that one of the bands before us that had that comical edge, which AOD, you seem to be sharing a resurgence label with, where this Beer City is putting out a lot of old archived records. And is that their sort of their thing, is just putting out older records?
Mike, he does seem to be putting out a lot of older records, that is for sure. But I think he's still got his hands in putting out newer records, although Beer City's got a pretty extensive catalog. I mean, they have, like, you know, they have like the Vandals, I think. Yeah, so he seems to be more reissued. He kind of started as more of a quote-unquote, I think, you know, street punk label, and then he kind of morphed into doing a lot of reissues of old stuff. So
yeah, because I talked to Bruce occasionally, and he was pretty excited. I mean, I got all the reissues of all the AOD stuff from him, so that was pretty cool.
Did they reissue Ishtar yet?
It's on the list, but I don't know if it has been done yet. I don't know. It's on.
Ishtar hasn't dropped.
What the hell with the Vespa to Venus? You said you went in and you did it pretty quickly, but how many years was it between their records? What was the deal?
It was about 19 years between albums. Well, it was just sort of like, you know, the four of us, which is like the Mega Anal lineup, which is about the 1996, 97, late 95 lineup. We've been in contact and stuff, but you know, Boris completely ended, ground to a halt in 2003. different three guys with me than there's other three guys that are currently in the band. And we didn't do anything or didn't plan to do anything ever again. And then it was in 2009. Now I can't remember, and I should remember this. Well, something like that. Something like 2009, like Insubordination Fest in Baltimore, that big festival. They were like, you guys want to play? And they'd asked me like a year or two before that. And I was always like, no, we're done. That's it. We're not doing anything. Forget it. And then for whatever reason that year, I was just like, you know, it wouldn't be so bad. Maybe we could do that. So I got in, you know, got in contact with those three guys, and, you know, it was kind of tenuous. We got buy-in and we played like a reunion show, you know, in Baltimore in 2009. I think it was 2009. And it went okay. It wasn't great, but I mean, the show went fine from a show end, but, you know, as far as us being a band and being together, it was kind of, but we kept in contact after that. And we were always like, well, you know, we should make one more album because that last album was kind of cheesy. I didn't really like it. And eventually around 2018 or something, we'd always sort of been writing songs and sending song ideas back and forth over the internet. Finally, we just said, let's just freaking get together and let's make that album that we've been talking about, because otherwise we're going to die and we're never going to make it. So we showed up at the studio, never having practiced those songs, and off we went.
Did everyone bring in different material, or is that how the band works? Did you bring in everything, or what was the sort of dynamics of that?
Usually I write most of the words, although I did not write all the words. Rick wrote a few songs, and Paul wrote a few songs, and I wrote a few songs, and then there were a number where Rick and Paul just had the music, and I wrote the words to that. I'm kind of a simpleton as a musician, so I found that it's usually best if I only write the music to maybe five songs per album, because otherwise my limited talents are exposed and everything kind of sounds the same, and I don't know when my songs aren't as good as they should be, so sometimes I write too many of them and things like that.
All right, so did you come in with lyrics for songs that you did not have music for yet?
No, I mean, we had, everything was pretty much somewhere on a MP3 that somebody sent to somebody somewhere.
yeah. So you had all the practice tapes of it already before you walked in.
That song Whip Map Woo was like sort of thrown together at the last moment because a couple of us had heard it, and Paul number two, the drummer, hadn't heard it, but we'll, you know, you're in the studio, just okay, just play along and whatever. And we kind of worked it out.
Now, Norb, you're pretty known for your voice, and you know, you have a lot of the intros to songs. Did Norb and who you are become a character at some point, or is it just you, or are you just you?
I'm not sure how to answer that. I'm not sure if I'm sure that like the character is kind of like, you know, I'm sort of a character. I'm sort of a comic book character in real life, but you know, like the character me is probably me, the comic book character, like over amplified. So I'm really, really a comic book character because I, you know, I might be playing up certain angles of my personality at certain times, but it's kind of like who I am. It's not like, I don't think that I've strayed too far from my core principles or anything like that.
Yeah. I'm just interested in that question because once again, the theater company, I am part of the Neo Futurists. We don't play characters. We're ourselves on stage, but I always say that it's about attempting to be yourself on stage because you're always aware that you are on stage. So you're going to put some facade on or a magnification of yourself. So, and I know for a lot of front men, I know that sort of sometimes they've come into conflict with their own, what they're perceived as in the eye of the public and their own view of themselves.
I mean, I don't think to a terrible extent. I mean, I will cop to see if I've been mowing the lawn and then I have a show to play. I'm probably not going to wear the same clothes I was wearing mowing the lawn to the show or whatever, but you know, yeah. I'm sort of a reasonable facsimile of myself on stage, I think, except it's, you know, a bit more presented, a bit more codified, a bit more boiled down to the quintessence of the platonic ideal of Norb Dumb or something. Or
have you ever done voiceover? Like, besides punk music and...
Not really. I mean, I used to work in the video game, so I'd throw like my voice in video games, stuff like that when I used to work in that industry, but not really. I don't think I really have the vocal chops anymore because I haven't sung in a band for quite some time, and I don't really think I have the golden pipes anymore, and I don't know if I can get them back.
Well, you sound pretty good. You sound almost the same to me, but I mean, there's a difference between singing and just talking normally. I wanted to talk a little bit about the costuming. I guess I have two different strains of thinking. One is just in costuming in general, because I don't know. I thought recently I was thinking of this. My friend that I used to live in England used to talk about how Brian Ferry and Roxy Music used to come to his thrift store before their shows and just buy whatever they had and wear that on stage. So it seemed more of a planned but yet accidental of what they ended up looking like on stage. Did you have any intentions with yours from show to show? Was it more random?
No, I mean, like when we played our first show, I wore weird stuff, but that was all stuff that I bought previously. That's all, you know, stuff that's in my closet, checkered spandex bike shorts. And I really got a lot of noises in my house.
Right? You got a lot of stuff.
You know, I don't know. I had some sort of kooky looking fluorescent pink vest or whatever the heck I was wearing. And that was just sort of stuff that I thought, well, these are kind of cool clothes of mine. That's just a nice outfit, goes together. I'm going to dress up kooky. I just thought, well, I like these shorts and I like that vest, so I think I'll wear it on stage. And the first time I wore that antler helmet, which some radio guys gave to me, I'd had that, and we were playing a show during deer hunting season or something like that. And I think Paul was wearing a orange, you know, blaze orange hunter suit, and I was going to wear the deer helmet. It was just supposed to be like a deer hunting joke thing. And I just thought, this is the dumbest thing in the world, but I'm going to wear this motorcycle helmet with antlers on it. You know, people get a kick out of it because it's deer hunting themed. But then people were just, oh, wow, that's just the most tremendous thing in the world. So then I had to wear this thing all the time, you know, and then I wound up wearing, you know, like Wolverine Halloween costumes and M&M Halloween costumes. Then it kind of got into like legitimate costumery. But the idea before that wasn't really an idea. It was just, I'm just going to wear my own weird freaking clothes, and that ought to be sufficient because I've got plenty of weird freaking clothes.
That reminds me, I often talk about this period in Weasel when we reformed to do which one was that? Bark Like a Dog. And we had a meeting with Larry, and they had just, the other guys had just gotten out of doing the Riverdales. So, and you know, and they did the Ramones, you know, jeans, t-shirt, leather jacket. And Ben said at this meeting, we're going to do this. We're going to continue this jeans, t-shirt and leather jacket thing in Weasel. So we're going to now have this uniform. And I was like, what? It's like I was proud of the thing about Weasel was always we had that, like, I thought like that you guys had too, that you just did whatever you wanted, you know, on stage, you know, physically, to, as long as you were doing the music and doing, you know, putting the energy into it, what you looked like was up to you, you know. And it was kind of a conflict we had, and I think I won that battle because we did not become another Ramones ripoff band. But I just wonder if there's ever been, I guess that was leading to this question of, was there ever a time where did you want to make any kind of statement, I guess, that could have been, I don't know, shadowed by the antics and the costuming? Was there ever any reason, need for you to make political or moral or personal statement?
I don't know that there was ever a massive reason. I think, you know, our statement was that we weren't going to take anything entirely too seriously, and we were going to poke fun at various sacred cows along the way and kind of, hopefully everybody will have a good time and whatnot. I don't think I ever needed to come out and, I don't know, tell anybody how to do something or how to vote, or I don't know how to live their lives. I don't think I'm qualified to do that. I don't think I really needed to make a big statement other than, here we are, this is what we do. And that's the statement, man. That's the entirety of the statement. Does that make any sense to your question?
No, I think it does make sense. I deal with that question. I don't know, creativity in general, or I love talking about it, but it's one of the most difficult things to discuss because some things are just, you just feel and you do it. So, and it doesn't make for a good answer, but to me, it's still worth exploring what drives us to do the things we do. And I think people like us, where we, even though we've dedicated our lives to being in bands or music and the passion of it, it never really became, and it wasn't a failure, it just never became the main mission in our lives. Like I wasn't trying to shoot to be a super band or anything like that. And I feel like you weren't either. It just didn't seem to be in your trajectory.
I mean, it doesn't really seem to be, I mean, I you know, you were probably closer to that by an order of magnitude in Weasel for that potentiality of being like a super band than, you know, Boris were. I think, you know, some people say I have a defeatist attitude about being in a band, but I think I have kind of a realistic attitude. I think I realize what the limits of the appeal are and what the ceiling is for, you know, what you can do. And I mean, we're not going to get played on whatever they have instead of MTV now. I mean, Boris aren't going to be a big super hit. We're not going to, there's no real reason to aspire to that, because there's no real realistic chance, at least in my mind, that we're going to appeal to that many people, because we're just not. It just, I don't see it happening. So I don't think there was any reason to really think, God damn it, I'm going to get on the cover of Spin or Die Trying, because you have to have sort of realistic goals, I think. And that wasn't the point anyway, really. We were just trying to amuse ourselves.
That's, I guess that's what I'm getting to the point about it, because you can see a lot of bands all through every decade that they're doing one music and then all of a sudden they realize something else is more popular and they try to switch to that. Like you saw a lot of like metal bands become like new wave bands, like in the 70s to the 80s, and you know, in the 80s to the 90s, you know, bands that were just doing rock become punk rock bands, or you know. And I feel like there is sort of a statement you're making in that, because you could have just gone, well, let's become a different band now, but you didn't. So it wasn't just a limitation of your own band. It was the, I don't know, to me, the goal of, I don't know what you thought was important.
I don't see any, people are always like, you know, I really have to give you credit for being yourself. Well, who else can you be? Realistically, you have no other option but to be yourself. So it's not like, you know, you get a medal for not, I don't know, doing whatever. I can't even imagine what we would have done. We're not going to be good at doing anything other than what we're doing. We can't go metal and try to sound like the Hives or something like that. That's not going to, well, the Hives aren't metal, but we can't, you know, we can't aspire to sound like Nato Coles and the Blue Diamond Band, or, you know, Motorhead, or, you know, anybody you have in your mind, because it's not going to work for us. We're not going to pull it off. It's going to be, we will be immediately shown up for what we are. It's a bunch of people trying to be what they're not, and we'll be embarrassed, and it's going to suck anyway. And what's the point of all of that? We're just doing the thing. Here it is. Damned if it ain't Boris the Sprinkler.
What is your life I mean, of course, obviously you look at your, I don't know, we're in our 50s now, right? I think you're in your 50s. So you know, you put up all the years we've dedicated to a band, and it's not the bulk of our lives. So what else are you, Norb?
That's a darn good question. I mean, right now, what are any of us during this pandemic, man?
I know. I guess that's why I'm asking that question a lot lately, of myself and others.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of soul searching, because you know, I'm like most people, I'm not doing a lot, and I'm kind of getting used to it. I'm like, you know, I can see this retirement thing. I see what the appeal of the retirement thing is. You can just sort of sit around and take a walk and maybe watch a little wrestling on TV, read a little bit. I'm kind of not terribly torn up that I'm not doing anything of value right now, which I'm sort of disturbed that that's not bothering me more, but I'm just, what can you do? You got to kind of roll with it. What am I? I don't know. You know, I kind of do stuff. I play music and I write stuff and I don't know. I read stuff and I listen to stuff and, you know, I don't know, go to work and eat candy and junk food. And there you go.
Can you still handle all the candy and junk food?
I mean, not as well as I could, but I do have a stack of gummy worms in the refrigerator that I'm just, you know, can't get my hands off.
What if you, did you go to school for a certain career, and are you doing that? Or have you jumped around, or what was your financial state of being supported your band?
I started going to school. I wanted to be a science major. I wanted to be a physics major. I went for a year and I decided that I did not really like that so much as a course of action, because I really hated working and like I had to do the lab work and measuring things. And then if you ever studied science at all, you heard if it stinks, it's chemistry. If it wiggles, it's biology. If it doesn't work, it's physics. So you're doing all these physics experiments and they never come out right. And I'm just like, I can't stand this shit. And it seemed, so I didn't like it. So I sat down and I'm like, well, what would I like to do with my life? What would be a job that I could see myself getting and enjoying it? Well, I like to be a graphic artist. I like to, you know, learn how to do things like on album covers. Like some album covers have, you know, red background and blue lettering. Well, how do you do that? I don't know. It's before computers. I'd like to learn how to do that because I think that would be interesting. I could see myself going to work and doing that sort of thing. So then I changed my major and I went and I kind of got this sort of graphic arts kind of thing, but it really wasn't that good of an education. And as soon as I graduated, all the techniques I'd learned were worthless because then computers came into being. So I sort of scraped around working at sort of a weekly newspaper doing the art there, and eventually I got bored with that. That's what I did when I was in Boris, and I went back to school to learn how to design video games, and I did that for 5 years, and that was kind of a freaking racket. I mean, If you like to work 40 hours a week, no, if you like to work 70 hours a week and get paid for 40, it's a great job. Otherwise, wasn't really that big of a video game guy anyway. I kind of don't like them. I think they're stupid, but I thought working on video games and making them would be fun, and it was had its moments. So I did that for 5 years. Then I lost my job because the company I was with first fired me, then went out of business. And then I wound up in printing just because I extended my unemployment benefits as far as they would go, and I needed a job. So I wound up being an ink technician at a printing place. And now I do pre-press graphics at a different printing place. And that's actually pretty suitable work for me. I kind of like that. And I have forgotten absolutely what your question was.
Well, you just finished your history, and then that's exactly the question I asked. So you didn't really forget.
All right. Synchronicity.
No, I mean, you probably admit you're a man of many words. When you speak, you say a lot of words. Do you believe in any sort of simplicity? I mean, like, are there parts of your life that you feel are best being simple?
I think everything is best being simple. Unfortunately, I think you have to have really a lot of talent to be able to do things successfully simply. And for those of us that don't have that talent, like me, you just throw everything you can at the window and see what doesn't slide down or something like that.
Well, you still have to have that part of you that then picks through all that stuff you threw out and makes something more simple out of it. So I don't know. I think you're undercutting yourself. Do you really have that self-esteem problem, or is that a part of you?
It seems legitimate, because if you try to, like, if you do something simple, it has to be exactly right. And I don't think I have, you know, it doesn't seem to be in my nature to make something that's simple and exactly right. I have to, like, have this bunch of things. I have to, like, say 1,000 words and hope that 500 of them are, like, really good, as opposed to just saying 500 words and stopping.
I was putting too much into that, because that's not really, it doesn't seem to be a self-esteem. If it's that, it's more of an acknowledgement of the way that your brain works, that it's best for you to just throw everything out there.
Yeah, I suppose you're probably correct. I don't know if I don't have the patience or I don't have the craftsmanship, but if I try to do really simple things, then again, I've written some kind of simple music, but that might just because of a limitation of my musical abilities. I'm not sure. It seems like I have to do things more like with a shotgun than with a laser. Or so it seems.
Why would that be?
I'm not sure. That just sort of seems to be the way things have worked out.
So even as a kid, were you the one usually talking in a room?
I don't know. I'm actually sort of a naturally introverted. I can't even say the word. I'm sort of an introverted, kind of shy person. But I mean, if I have to interact with somebody, as I have to do now, then I could just sort of spew and talk and babble on. It's kind of just a sort of a skill you have to develop. And I, you know, maybe it kind of ran amok with me. I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, I've seen that in a lot. I mean, and being in the theater world too, I see a lot of the actors that I know that are like so charismatic on stage, and you think they're like very energetic off stage. And most of them tend to be more quiet and introverted when they're off stage. I guess that's why I asked if you're Boris the Sprinkler was verging on character, because it just seems like an energy that's hard to keep up all the time.
Yeah, I mean, when you get off stage, you certainly don't feel like talking a million miles an hour and jumping around. You're kind of spent, so you're just going to sort of sit there with your hands in your pockets for the rest of the night, and that's going to be all she wrote. But, yeah. You know, I think that's all right. You know, you marshal the energy when you need it, and then when you don't, you just sort of kind of coast.
Are you in your basement?
I'm not in my basement. I don't have a basement. My home has no basement. I wish I had a basement. I'd have places to keep my stuff.
It seems like, just from the view behind you, is your whole house similar to, do you have stuff everywhere, Norm?
There's stuff. That's another thing. I don't have that minimalist like design. Like some of those guys have those fancy mid-century modern pads, like Greg Lowery or John Vaughn or whatever, where it's all tastefully decorated and there's, you know, just a smattering of real nice looking things. I just have all the things, and all the things are all around me because I don't have a basement. So yeah, my approach to talking appears to be my approach to home decoration, because my house is filled with things.
I'm going to do a test with you here. Can you just randomly grab something from the shelves behind you?
Randomly? Very well.
Yeah. Just grab.
All right.
What is it?
It is Star Trek DVD Volume 10, Episodes 19 and 20. It's Arena, my third favorite Star Trek episode ever. and the alternative fact.
Well, okay. Now tell me something about it that's more about your relationship to it and not about what it is.
Well, my relationship to these Star Trek things is that I got a DVD player in about, say, 1999, I don't know. And Star Trek was always one of my favorite shows. So I thought, I've got this DVD player, and they are releasing the Star Trek episodes on these wonderful new things called DVDs, two at a time. And they release maybe, I don't know if it's like one a month, or it wasn't real quick. But so I bought each and every one of the 40 DVDs. And I thought, this is just the most wonderful thing. I've got all 80 or 79, if you don't count the pilot as an episode. I've got all the episodes of Star Trek, the original series. I've got my 40 DVDs. This is the height of technology. This is the most wonderful thing. I know these are great, and they're wonderful, and I love them. And you know, then they, years later, not too many years later, they put them all out as one box set, and you could buy it for a fraction of the price. But I got all these on, I don't know if it was Amazon.com or what. As soon as they came out, I would buy the new one, and I did that for as long as it took to get all 40 DVDs. So now I got 40 DVDs. I'm glad that I like how they look.
I own a house, and I've had a lot of people live here. Like, cause I worked in Japan for the last 6 years, so I haven't been here, and I've always rented out part of my house, like to Vapid and a bunch of other musicians and people that have stayed here. So I've accumulated a lot of stuff. So I've started throwing stuff away, and I've really, and my own stuff too, I've started throwing away because I just need space. And my friend that I own the house with, high school friend, is a hoarder. So I'm trying to do my part in trying to clear stuff out. So I guess I'm really interested in what you hold on to and what you don't. Like I came upon these box of VHSs I would never use again. And he was resistant to me throwing them away. And I was like, I'm never going to have a VHS player again. Why should I keep these? What is your feeling on that? I mean, do you ever have to relinquish stuff? Are you overflowing with stuff?
I do have a problem relinquishing stuff, but you know, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. I sort of did the thing where I went through my record collection and started picking out the albums that I'm probably never going to listen to. And then I listened to all the albums to make the final judgment on, does it stay or does it go? And I was able to pare some down that way. Things like cassettes. I'm like, I hate cassettes. I can't stand them. I never really could like them. There's a big, gigantic boxes of cassettes in my kitchen cupboards. And I went through like all the cassettes we had in the Boris van. And I threw just about all of those away. It's like, don't look, just throw. And a couple I had to save from immolation. But every now and again, you got to just kind of close your eyes and do it.
I'm going to take a slight pause here because I've just been having fun with saying whatever's on the top of my head. But I do have things that I do want to talk about specifically. Oh, did you ever make it to Japan?
Never been in Japan. No, never did. Now it's like that's on the Boris wish list to play in Japan, and we never did.
I never got to. Well, I didn't play with the band, but I actually ended up working for Universal Studios as a Harry Potter wizard. So I've been there for the last 5 or 6 years. So I've always wanted to do that too. I've always wanted to go for music, and I ended up going as like a wizard. So it was pretty bizarre, but I ended up meeting a lot of really cool punks there. You know, it's one of those scenes that now is so submerged. It wasn't as huge as it was like in the 90s, when it probably would have been probably the best to go there then. But there's a lot of bands that have really committed to it for like 30 or 40 years.
So. I have to say, it's awesome that you're a Harry Potter wizard. I'm just going to cut you off right there and say it's awesome that you're a traveling Harry Potter, an international Potter wizard.
Yeah, I actually got the job, and I had to go there and learn Japanese because the show is completely in Japanese. So
yeah,
I learned to speak Japanese. So that's why I was in this interview. You talked about wanting to get to Japan. Did you have any other reasons besides like a lot of most bands I knew just wanted to eventually sometime go to Japan? Do you have any other connections as like a collector or anything? Or?
I don't need to buy any sort of pricey Godzilla mementos because I got enough crap in my house. But I mean, I would like to also go there as sort of a tourist and go down to the Shinjuku district or however you say that and look at all the wacky crap.
Did Boris Sprinkler ever have a period of time that was where you considered yourself a touring band?
I don't think we were ever real. I never really considered us a touring band just because we always kept our day jobs. So we'd go on like a tour for, you know, 2 weeks or whatever in the summer. And then the rest was just, it was like weekend jaunts. So Friday night, we'd throw the crap in the van, we'd go play in Chicago, and then maybe Saturday we could get to Cleveland or somewhere like that, and Sunday we'd drive home and back to the 9 to 5 on Monday. So we do that for quite a while. And it seemed to work out pretty well for us, but it kind of, you know, it sort of limits you to your geographical reach.
This is my naivete of all the information about a band, but did you ever make it to the coasts?
Yeah, we did that. We used to go to the East Coast every other year, and then we went to the West Coast once. We went to Texas once, and that kind of thing. We kind of tried to go to the East Coast once. Yeah, we go to the East Coast one year, but the next year we would go somewhere else that we hadn't been. The next year we go back to the East Coast because it's easier to do the East Coast because there's a lot of cities there and they're all kind of close together, and you just throw a dart at a dartboard and you book it and you have fun.
The biggest problem is you're just dealing with a lot of other bands that want to be touring because it's easier to tour the East Coast. West is, you know, you drive like 2 days and you haven't even gotten to the next venue yet.
Yeah, we drive, you know, you drive 500 miles a night, which is fine. Then you play at, you know, you play at a VFW or somewhere. You play at a record store in Las Vegas on a Tuesday afternoon or whatever it is. From an ease and a sort of return, as far as our vacation time went, we usually like to go to the East Coast because that just sort of, it all worked out well for us. We liked it.
Now, you obviously, even though these other boys and Paul tricked you into being the front man for the band, you became the front man, and there probably is no Boris Sprinkler without Reverend Norb in the front. But are you the businessman too? Are you, do you split those duties or what?
Generally, yes. I would be like the business guy, the guy who'd have to schmooze the club owners and, you know, talk to the record label guy or do whatever. That all sort of went through me. Nowadays, it's probably a little more dispersed because we're not really a together band because our bass player lives in New Jersey and whatnot. So, you know, Paul, number one, the guitar player, is he's really the most active. He's the guy that really, you know, probably reaching out to people and finding out stuff. And I'm gonna kind of let whatever happens kind of stance. So maybe I'm kind of lazy. I'm not sure.
But you had, you know, the connection through MRR, so you knew all of the venues and scenes that were going on around. So did you do any of the, whatever the small amount of touring you did you do the booking of those?
Yeah, I think so. Sometimes we would like we'd use somebody else to book the tour because sometimes they're better at that. Sometimes we didn't, I think, as far as I can tell. Yeah, but so I would do the booking and all that crap mostly. For tours, sometimes we had people help us because we're dumb or lazy. Whatever it is, we are for that.
I found this really interesting that you had. I have this other podcast where I explore one record and I get into like the histories of each member and like how they came to music. And I heard you say that you had a stereo when you were about 5 or 6 where you heard your Jan and Dean 7-inch.
It wasn't even a stereo. It was one of those little portable things that we used to call a close and play.
Yeah, but I was taken by that your parents didn't have a musical source like that. Is that true?
That is correct. I was the only person with a record player in the whole household, and I got it for Christmas when I was 3. So it's just one of those little ones that, you know, it folds up into a little suitcase. You know what I'm talking about, though, right?
Yeah, I know exactly. I had one too. Yeah. Because you had mentioned the Jungle Book, and I kind of took to that because I had Mary Poppins and a bunch of Disney records and then too. But I was just interested, is anybody in your family, were they musical in any way or creative artists?
My dad is not a creative whatsoever guy. He's very much ex-Marine kind of work-a-day kind of dude. He absolutely nothing like that. My mom has actually had a couple children's books published and she plays the piano and things like that. So it wasn't like I was living in a completely amusical family, but nobody gave a shit about music enough to buy a stereo, apparently. When I was about maybe 9 or something, then my dad bought one, 9 or 10, 9.
I guess that struck me because I was thinking that was odd. But then when I thought about my family, I was like, oh, no one else had a record player. My parents didn't. I mean, they weren't non-musical. They just had a stereo system with no, you know, vinyl player or anything like that. So it wasn't that uncommon, I guess, not to have a record player in the house.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you had a little portable radio at the kitchen corner and they turned that on. And I always find it really, like, you know, crazy finding out people who are in bands and stuff like that. My peers, you know, they're talking about, well, you know, I've had a lifelong love for music since I found Meet the Beatles in my parents' record collection. And, oh, my dad had this record. And it's like, well, I don't have any of that shit. I had to figure it all out myself, you know. I didn't have anybody's records I could go snorting through.
I'll give like family members as references to how I discovered something, but I wouldn't say that's how I discovered music for myself. I found my own way pretty early on, but I had older brothers and they were into like Zappa and My brother's was, his room was like a wonderland of pot smoke and Circus magazine posters. So I would go in and discover like a new band every week on his walls and his sort of fire trap, like crispy Circus magazine posters that on his walls. So I guess I had a heavy influence from that. But then I think I discovered the music that I'm into most now, Friends and just going to the record store weekly.
Yeah, I discovered a fair amount of music when I was like 11, 10, 11, 12 by my best friend who I wound up in my first band with. He had an older sister. We'd sneak into her room and she wasn't there and we could look into her records. That's how we discovered Aerosmith and, I don't know, she had Ballroom Blitz by Sweet. Grand Funk Railroad or something like that. I can't remember. She'd kill us if she knew we were pushing her records, but we would do it anyway. But yeah, I had to steal somebody else's, or not steal, but I had to, you know, sneak into somebody else's older sibling's room.
I feel like I want to ask you this question, even though it has nothing to do with what I had planned out. But do you have any guilty pleasures? But I really am more curious in, do you believe in the idea of guilty pleasures?
that's a good question, because people will occasionally ask, what are your guilty pleasures? And I'm like, I think I've been pretty public with everything I like, regardless of whether they're even fit for human consumption or for, you know, mixed company or not. But I think there are probably things that I'm less acutely inclined to admit that I like, just because, you know, they're kind of pedestrian and they're kind of things that aren't that interesting or whatever. Like, you know, I like football. I've been known from time to time to be sort of fixated on NBA basketball, which I'm not now because I think the Bucks screwed everything up and now I'm sad because they should have won the title for the last 2 years and they did. So things like that, it's like, you know, I don't, you know, that's a lot less of a conversation starter than say, well, yes, I do have Amazing Fantasy number 15 and the first 102 issues of Amazing Spider-Man. You know, that seems to convey more personality than, yeah, you know, I really enjoyed that NBA Finals between, or the Western Conference Finals between the Lakers and the Portland Trail Blazers in 2001. That was really something else, or, you know, whatever. So.
I think I've always been fascinated with the idea of guilty pleasures because it puts, it's putting someone else's, a judgment of yourself over your own judgment of what you like to listen to or do. Or
you have to step outside yourself and imagine what your guilty pleasure would be so you can relate this properly. Because, you know, like I like musicals, for instance, or at least old musicals.
Yeah.
But that's not guilty, but it doesn't come up a lot in conversation. But, you know, if it did, I'd go, well, yes, I do love West Side Story and Guys and Dolls and Music Man. But I don't know if that's a guilty pleasure. It depends who you're, if you're talking to somebody who would really think that was uncool, you might present that as a guilty pleasure because they'd be like, oh man, that's really a guilty pleasure. You are so guilty. But if you were talking to a music teacher, then that wouldn't make a very good guilty pleasure because it wouldn't have that same impact.
I think I've been thinking about this a lot lately because I think the scene, but the punks that we were traveling around and doing with, it's somewhere it took a turn where it became more standard of what was acceptable, which was weird because I don't know. I remember a lot of the punk shows, you just had a bunch of weird, great, unique, strange people that were, sometimes you'd had someone playing piano open for you who was thinking about opposable thumbs, you know, singing about that. And so I guess my fascination with guilty pleasures also goes with how sometimes a scene will limit its view of the world. For some reason, I don't know quite sure why. And I think the pop punk scene did that to itself.
Yeah, because I mean, I remember when I first started going to punk shows, which is way the hell back when I was 15 or whatever, people would sort of invent their own things to wear that, you know, I don't, like somebody might have a mousetrap with a, wear it on their lapel or whatever. Or you look at the cover of that Haskell's album, their guitar player or the bass player is wearing Viewmaster reels, safety pinned or clipped or somehow on his shoes. Like, yeah. Nobody ever said, hey, wearing Viewmaster reels, that's punk. Everybody wear Viewmaster reels. And some guy just says, like, I'm going to take these things from Viewmaster, I'm going to put them on my shirt, and that's cool because I say it's cool. And no one's done it before. Nobody's done it since. You would just see stuff like that. Like, people would just invent things.
There was a Chicago guy, I can't remember, he was a friend of Vapid. I think his name was Gar or something, but he used to safety pin stuffed animals to his leather jacket.
Yeah. Yeah, just, you know, stuff like that. People would just, I don't know, punk rock industrial arts or something. Make an armband, do whatever. it wasn't like you were following, you weren't following a set of, I don't know, I guess punk rock, discussion of punk rock always sort of descends of whether you're following a set of rules or not. So apparently this discussion might have been rehashed for the last 40 years. I don't know. But it did seem like you had a lot more just people who were just attracted to the sense of I can do some sort of spontaneously creative thing. And we're just going to say, yeah, there we go. That's part of what the thing is now.
I have to wrap this up soon, but let me try to formalize this thought. I see you as someone who's pretty smart. Were you considered smart when you were like a kid? Were you in like the higher classes? Or
I'm afraid I was. I'm afraid I was. Right, bright future in store for me until I discovered punk rock.
Because in some of the ways you talk are like some of the ways that my friend like Mass Giorgini talks, who is another super genius guy, that sometimes knowing too much restricts you. And I see you fighting this, that restricts you from saying something because it's been said before or done before, or like you said, punk rock's been dealing with this problem for 40 years. So it's not really a question in there. I think it's just interesting frame of mind. And I don't consider myself that intelligent, but
I do feel
that those instincts sometimes prevent you from being more creative and more adventurous. And I just wonder if that happened to the, like, too much acknowledgement of the pop punk scene or the punk scene, which it was, caused it to sort of limit its own view in that way.
Or is the limiting thing just a natural function of this is what happens when you get people with a common interest together pretty soon? The echo chamber effects. Everything becomes its sort of own orthodoxy, and the more fringe elements just get batted to the side, and pretty soon everybody's in lockstep, and then they're bored and they don't know why.
And how do you feel in your life? Have you fought that at all? Did you feel like you just naturally fall out of that? Do you feel like you're too much stuck in that, or is it just the way that life is? And
You probably can't avoid feeling that if you're in a rut or whatever we want to call this sort of entropy or whatever. I think eventually that will make itself manifest to you, and you're going to be naturally just looking or striving for something different, because you're not, you know, people just don't have one set of likes. There's different flavors of things you like, and you go, well, I'm really sick of doing this, and everybody's doing the same thing. I want to do something else because that was kind of fun too, and this has been beat to death, so I'll just start doing that. Or I don't know, you adapt and overcome.
Yeah.
And if you don't, then you just wind up in lockstep conformity and you don't have a very good time.
Yeah. One of my last thoughts here is you said you studied science. I still think you have a science brain. Is that still a big part of your, do you keep up on the sciences, or do you enjoy that?
At one point in time, I would sort of like routinely devour the whatever books on pop science came out. And then I noticed that in the wake of A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking, that got like big mainstream, you know, adoration. And I think not to be a jerk, but I think part of that was that there was this sort of character, you know, people could get behind the story of this guy with ALS having this brilliant brain trapped in this body in this wheelchair. And that would be sort of a hook where, you know, the suburban housewife or whatever kind of, whatever stereotype you want could go, well, oh, there's this guy and he's, you know, got ALS and he can't move, but he's got all these brilliant thoughts. So that would sort of, you know, give them a hook where they would want to pick up this book and read it, because then there was something about it that, you know, kind of spoke to them. Whereas if it was just some book on science, they wouldn't give it the time of day. And then what started happening, in my opinion, is that the editors of these books started trying to get that same sort of emotional pathos kind of thing going on with all their authors, with all their books, when it was misplaced, when it was just, you know, some guy writing about fourth dimensional hyperspace or something. And then there was some obligatory thing where he'd have to talk about how he had a bad relationship with his dad. And pretty soon it just became sort of stupid and I didn't like it anymore. And then I kind of stopped reading those books and I haven't really picked up on it, but my mind still thinks in weird sort of terms like that sometimes. But
yeah, I feel like I feel like your mind does work in that way. Like as a scientist mind does. I mean, there's like, engineer minds. Like my best friend Jim is an engineer mind. He looks at the world as an engineer. I think I'm probably at core a creative being. I just, that's the way I see everything, is everyone's creating their own new thing. It's and I think there's science minds too, which I think sort of analyze the past and the present and now. And I don't know, some of the things you've said really affected me in that way, I guess. But what I wanted to say is that it's interesting you talked about the Stephen Hawking book, because I just heard a podcast with the guy who wrote that book with him. I can't remember his name, but he became really good friends with Stephen Hawking, and you know, and he talks a lot in his book about how Stephen Hawking would blink or something. You'd have to get, you know, the words would come really, really slow, so you had to sort of be patient. But he said that he had a long battle with Stephen Hawking over, I think it was Stephen Hawking saying philosophy was dead. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. And the guy who was writing the book with him struggled with this, because he was like, I don't think he means that. I think he means, and he confronted Stephen Hawking with this. And I guess Stephen Hawking, in his words, had said that that's what people will want to hear. It's purposely provocative. So I think Stephen Hawking even himself was aware of that. If he's going to make a book that was going to be more acceptable in the mainstream, he had to purposely make that move. So it wasn't just the editors. I think he was conscious of trying to bring that science into the mainstream.
Wow. I've been callously manipulated by a master thinker. Oh, well.
I think it goes hand in hand with what you were saying, because I agree too. It's the things that you, I think in any time you're going to introduce something to the world, there's always that in your mind, like, how do I appeal to these people? Do I care about those people? Do I care about these people? Do I want it to go out to a larger group of people? Because then we have to do what you were saying, where it has to even out and be a little less provocative, or it has to be provocative in a certain way. So to get that sort of, what do they call that? Gossip feel to it.
That's deep. You are a wizard.
Norm, I'm going to wrap it up here before I get too philosophical and put myself into a deep sleep. What got me on that last rant is you talked about playing the clarinet, and then you had said that you studied piano with sort of in your voice. It sounded like that's what triggered me, that guilty pleasure. But I wasn't sure that's quite what you were saying. You did study piano for a little while, and you had some music theory growing up, and you played the clarinet.
I played the clarinet in fourth grade through eighth grade. Wait, fifth grade? Fourth grade. Well, anyway.
Yeah. And the piano you took for a few years too then, right?
I think that was maybe third grade through eighth grade. And then I think I didn't want to do it anymore once I discovered punk rock, because then I wanted to buy a guitar or a bass, and you know how that goes.
Yeah, I do. But do you feel like that foundation is still a part of you? Do you think you didn't waste your time, did you?
No, I didn't waste my time, but I don't think I apply a whole ton of it. I mean, it's not like what really threw me is, you know, when you're playing piano and you're making a major chord into a minor chord, you take your middle finger and you move it down a half step to the key next to it, to its left. But if you do that on a guitar, you don't do it like that, because you make guitar chords a different way and the notes are different. And then I could never quite put the two together. So I think, you know, once I started figuring out guitar, then I just had to sort of forget the piano thing, because it just wasn't working for me, because you make chords differently.
Oh, that's interesting.
Your second finger on your guitar chord is like your third finger of your piano chord, I think. But then you play like the harmonic of what you'd be playing with your second finger on some other finger. Maybe I had that backwards, but it took me a long time. By the time I realized that, it was already no good, that just the chords didn't make sense to me.
See, to me, that's almost, if I try to think about it that much, I can't do it.
Well, exactly. So you can imagine my consternation.
All right, Norm. Thank you very much for this.
It's been a pleasure being here at Jughead's Jungle.
It is. My life is sometimes a jungle, but I thank you very much for doing this with me.
Thanks. I hope I made sense. I hope you can weed. I hope you can weed logic and something out of my ramblings.
Oh, I don't worry about that.
I don't worry about it either. That's why it's your problem. Okay, great.
All right, Norm, you have a good night.
Yourself as well.
Thank you very much. Goodbye, my friend. UFO.
If you have made it this far, you have just gotten done listening to UFO by Boris the Sprinkler on their 1998 release of Suck on Go-Kart Records. Once again, please, if you can, go to our www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com. Look for that little button that says Patreon, press it, and for $2, $5, or $10 a month, you can become a Patreon to keep this program programming. And that's all I have to say. So really, thank you all. Thank you very much. Post a review. We need more of those. We need it. We need it. We need it now. We need it now. We're always on the edge of destruction. So let's go over that edge with some pleasurable podcasts to listen to. Jughead's Basement being one of them. Among many. I don't care. I'm not jealous. All right. Thank you. And goodbye from Tampa Bay, Florida, where I'm visiting Chris Barrows from the Pink Lincolns, the Spears, and the Chris Barrows Band. All right.